If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For author and historian Neil Faulkner, the 21st century war on terror echoes a series of conflicts that erupted across North Africa and the Middle East back in the Victorian era, an episode that he chronicles in his new book, Empire and Jihad. It's a story that takes in imperialism, anti-slavery, moral panics, and Islamist revolts. Here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Neil reveals how these conflicts changed the course of history.
Neil, your new book offers a fresh analysis of the Anglo-Arab Wars of 1870 to 1920. Now, I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners won't know a great deal about this episode in history. So I was wondering if you could start by giving us a brief overview of the wars.
Yeah, well, I think the very essence of it really is that it begins ostensibly as a humanitarian mission, or what is packaged as a humanitarian mission, a response to the surging of the Arab East African slave trade. Of course, at a time when the Western slave trade, the European slave trade, was being suppressed, and at a time when there was a very, very strong abolitionist movement, not least in Victorian Britain, that was then fired up from the middle of the 19th century onwards, particularly by David Livingstone, but also by other travellers, other explorers who were going into Africa and were discovering this surging of the slave trade. Now, what develops out of this growing concern about the slave trade, and the reason it's surging, of course, is because the world economy is surging at the time. This is the great expansion of world capitalism in the 19th century, the building of empire, the Industrial Revolution taking off everywhere, huge increases in demand for primary commodities, including, particularly important in relation to Africa, ivory, which is then being transported by slave labor, and then the slaves become an additional commodity. This is one of the reasons why the whole thing is surging at the time. What you get is you get growing levels of particularly British intervention to try and deal with the surging slave trade. And this escalates into a confrontation, which is essentially a confrontation between British imperialism, where British imperialism is seeking to advance its control, to increase the amount of territory which is under British authority, to get control of raw materials and markets and so on, as part of this great expansion of European empire in the period. The scramble for Africa, of course, will be well known to listeners. This is part of that. But what this British imperial intervention does is something rather different from simply seeking to abolish slavery. It's about something much more than that. It's about layering on top of what is going on a new kind of oppression, a kind of coolie capitalism, European domination. And what that seems to trigger is an Arab Islamist jihadist reaction, which then sweeps across Northeast Africa. It's centered on the Sudan. And I'm sure that a lot of listeners will be familiar with the Mahdi, with General Gordon defending Khartoum, then later General Kitchener going down the Nile to reconquer the Sudan. That's the core of it. But actually, this jihadist movement is much broader than that. And what the book is trying to do is to look at that jihadist movement in the broadest possible sense, but to put it in the context of a reaction to British imperialism as British imperialism becomes an increasingly dominant force in the region in the late 19th century.
Now, you describe this, or say it could be described, as the first modern jihad. But what, in your opinion, qualifies this episode as a modern jihad?
Well, I mean, the idea of jihad, of course, goes right back to the origins of Islam. Though, let's be clear, there's nothing, holy war is not just an Islamic concept. It's very much a Christian concept as well. The whole of the Crusades, of course, were framed by the idea of holy war. So it's much broader than just Islam. But of course, it's there at the very beginning of Islam. And, you know, if we take the example of the Crusades, when Saladin mounts his great counter-offensive against the Crusades in the medieval period, he frames it as a jihad. He frames it as a holy war. So it's a very old idea. It's a medieval idea. But I think what is happening in the 19th century is that there is a recasting of that idea, almost a reinvention of that idea in the context of a threat from modernity, a threat from industrialism, a threat from modern imperialism. And it's a deeply reactionary movement now. And, you know, central to the book is the argument that this is a collision between two really deeply reactionary forces. On the one hand, British imperialism, which is all about the enrichment of a relatively small, you know, capitalist elite based in the West, you know, particularly London and Paris, actually, in relation to what's happening in the Middle East. So that does not represent a kind of progressive way forwards for the people of the region. But the Islamist reaction is also deeply reactionary, because what is happening here is that there's a rejection of the whole of modernity and a desire to turn the clock right back to a medieval past. And actually, at the very core of what the Islamists are trying to do is to defend the slave trade. So that in effect, the holy war, the jihadist war, the war waged by the Mahdi in the Sudan, the war waged by the Mad Mullah, as the British call him, in Somaliland, is actually about protecting the Arab slave trade against attempts to eradicate it in the context of creating a different kind of economy, controlled essentially by European imperialists.
So what were the main milestones in these wars? I mean, where did the two sides clash on the battlefield?
Well, I've already said very familiar is what happens in the Sudan. And there are two major phases in the conflict in the Sudan itself. There's a conflict in the early 1880s, which is when General Gordon is defending Khartoum, and there's an expedition which is sent to rescue him under Garnet Wolseley, which fails. That reaches its climax in 1884, 1885. And then the next sort of highlight, really, is the reconquest of the Sudan between 1896 and 1898 under General Kitchener, which is partly a response to the growing threat of other European imperial powers, actually. That's why the British want to secure control of the Sudan. Now, these are highlights, and they're relatively familiar to, you know, people interested in history. What I'm also trying to bring out in the book is that there's an earlier phase where there are major anti-slavery wars being fought in the 1870s, and they're actually being fought by people who are sort of almost freelancers working for the Turco-Egyptian authority at the time when the Sudan is actually under Turco-Egyptian authority, not under British authority. So General Gordon is there in the Sudan in the 1870s, but he has officers working for him who are actively trying to suppress the slave trade in the 1870s. And a major, major war actually is fought in the 1870s, and a quite successful one initially against the slave traders. So there's a lot of emphasis in the book on that earlier phase of the anti-slavery war. And then also what I try to do is I try to extend the story beyond the fall of the Sudan, the overthrow of the Khalifa, the caliphate that is created in the Sudan. And I show how the ripple effect produces an insurgency in Somalia that proves to be extremely intractable, very, very difficult to deal with, and carries on really right up until 1920, and how also in the context of the First World War, you get this deep concern on the part of the British authorities, actually, that there's going to be a jihadist revolt in the context of the First World War, stirred up by the Ottoman Empire, supported by Imperial Germany, because, of course, the British, like their allies in the First World War, the French and the Russians, they are responsible for lots and lots of Muslim subjects in their respective empires. So the possibility of a jihad spreading across the Islamic world is very, very worrying indeed for the Entente powers in the First World War. And we get echoes of that jihadist insurgency during the First World War. A major revolt, for example, in the Western Desert by the Senussi, who are essentially Islamists. So that's the central to the book, really, is an attempt to say, look, there's a single story here which is unfolding between 1870 and 1920. It's not just about what is happening in the Sudan, though that is very much at the core of the book.
Sure. Now, as you've already mentioned, you described this as a battle essentially between two systems of oppression, the Arab slave trade and, as you've already said, European coolie capitalism. I mean, for you, is that the real tragedy of this story, that there was no good guys in this, that there was two deeply flawed systems battling out against one another?
Well, again, one of the things I tried to highlight in the book is that I think there were, on the stage of history at this time, some good guys, but the good guys get taken out. And the a crucially important person for me is Colonel Arabi Pasha, who was a kind of precursor of General Nasser in the 1950s. He was an Egyptian nationalist leader. He was a liberal. He had a vision of Egypt becoming a developed modern state with a proper constitution, with the rule of law, all of those kind of liberal principles being applied to Egypt. And he becomes the leader of an Egyptian revolutionary movement in 1881-1882. Now, the problem as far as the British are concerned is that what Colonel Arabi represents is a movement of the ordinary Egyptian people to overthrow a client regime, which is ensuring that interest payments on the massive, massive Egyptian debt will continue to flow to bankers in London and Paris. And the Liberal Prime Minister, William Gladstone, authorizes a military expedition, a full-scale military expedition, to smash the Egyptian nationalist revolution, essentially in the interests of Anglo-French finance capital, in order to ensure that these flows of interest will continue to flow to the bankers. It's described at the time by critics as a bondholder's war, a banker's war. And of course, we are very, very familiar, aren't we, with the burden of debt being imposed on global South countries at the expense of the people of the region, who ultimately are having to pay these debts, enriching a small minority in the metropolitan centres of modern capitalism. It was the same sort of story unfolding in Egypt in 1881, 1882. And the smashing of that revolution, the decisive battle, which I look at in considerable detail in the book, was the Battle of Tel El Kebir. That smashing of the Egyptian nationalist revolution shuts off, in my view, a progressive alternative and opens the space, really, which the jihadists then fill with their reactionary program of a return to the Middle Ages. So instead of moving forwards to the creation of a modern Egypt and a modern Northeast Africa, we're pushed back to a choice between European imperialism or a kind of barbaric medieval jihadism.
What was life like for those caught in the middle of these conflicts, the quote-unquote dispossessed multitudes? I mean, what was it like to be caught up in all this bloodshed and chaos?
Well, I think it was pretty awful. I mean, you know, whether you were in Egypt or in Sudan, let us take those two examples, in the latter part of the 19th century, the great bulk of the population of Egypt, they were peasants working small plots of land in the delta or along on the banks of the Nile. They were subject to very high levels of taxation, brutally enforced. I mean, tax collection in Egypt in this period, as had been the case for thousands of years, actually, was a paramilitary operation. So the tax collectors would be going into the villages armed. They'd be armed with whips and with rifles. It was a brutal process of extracting surplus from an impoverished peasantry to support a client elite in Egypt, but more importantly, to sustain the flow of payments to the bankers. But in Sudan, under the authority of the Mahdists, because of course between 1885 and the reconquest in 1898, there is an Islamic caliphate in Sudan. It's no better. Certainly, if you are a slave, because we see a surging of the slave trade under the Islamist regime. But even if you are an ordinary Sudanese peasant, again, what you're having imposed upon you is very high levels, actually, of taxation, of labor service, of military conscription, in order to sustain the military infrastructure of the caliphate. So I think, worth saying as well, actually, that particularly if you were a woman, if you were a woman slave, if you were a woman peasant, you suffered multiple oppressions, whether you were in Egypt or in Sudan. And central to the book really is this sense that this is a dystopian situation that we have in the region in the late 19th century, with nothing positive, nothing progressive, nothing beneficial for the great majority of the ordinary people.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
He's seen as an idealist, therefore he's lionized by the Victorian public, but in a sense what's really happening here is that he's being used as an instrument for the advancement of British imperial interests, despite his own best intentions.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, so let's turn to Charles George Gordon, better known as Gordon of Khartoum, of course. As you point out, he was perhaps a consummate example of the new class of hero in Victorian Britain, while in fact suffering from bipolar disorder and religious mania. Can you tell us a bit about his character and his role in this story?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting fact. One of the things as a historian, I reject is this attempt to put everybody either into the black box or the white box. They're either baddies or they're goodies. History is not like that. History is much more complex. And characters, major historical characters, are multidimensional. And one of the things I argue in the book is that there are figures who emerge in the mid-Victorian period who are essentially benevolent in their outlook and in their aspirations. And I make this point about David Livingstone. I think it's true of him for all his faults. I make the point also about Charles Gordon for all his faults. He was an imperialist. He was a liberal imperialist. He was a Victorian soldier, and so on and so forth. But his intentions were essentially good. I think he was a deeply religious, a deeply conscientious man. I think his deep hostility to the slave trade was absolutely genuine. I think he was sometimes very, very naive about the people who were employing him and what their intentions were. But I think there's no question at all that he was a genuine abolitionist. So Gordon is a very, very interesting character from that point of view, because he's really, I think, torn apart by the contradictions. Because on the one hand, he is there in the Sudan as an abolitionist, as an idealist, as a man who wants to improve the lives of ordinary people. Yet he's trapped in a framework that prevents him from achieving that, from realizing that aspiration. And ultimately, he becomes a supreme symbol, actually, of British imperialism. And why is he able to do that? Well, it's precisely because he's not one of these gung-ho, hawkish figures who really don't connect with people, because they don't represent an ideal, they don't represent a vision, they don't represent something positive. Gordon does. Gordon is the ideal Victorian hero, because he is a man of God, because he is so conscientious, because he's a genuine abolitionist. He's seen as an idealist, therefore he's lionized by the Victorian public. But in a sense, what's really happening here is that he's being used as an instrument for the advancement of British imperial interests, despite his own best intentions.
Neil, you argue in the book that traditional English language accounts have often been either consciously or unthinkingly sympathetic to the imperial project. Often, you argue, far too sympathetic. And can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, we are now very much in a post-imperial age. But nonetheless, there is a strong legacy, isn't there, of the British Empire, bound up with British nationalism, British patriotism, British tradition, British history, and so on. It's still very, very much there. And I think that does still infect a lot of European, perhaps particularly British, historiography. I think it's still the case that the British Empire tends to be portrayed historically in an unjustifiably sympathetic way. That is still there. Whereas I would argue without hesitation that imperialism is invariably pernicious. It is invariably a matter of one society taking over the territory, the resources of another society, and exploiting them, using them for their own benefit. That's what imperialism is. Nobody builds an empire in the interests of the people who become the subjects of the empire. All empires are built in the interests of the empire builders. And we have to be absolutely clear about the nature of European imperialism and the ongoing legacy, really, of European imperialism, which is still there in the sort of relative underdevelopment of so much of the global south and in various kind of neo-colonial and arrangements that are still with us. On the other hand, what I think you tend to get is a kind of reverse of that, a kind of reaction to that in many of the countries which have been victims of imperialism, where figures who are actually very questionable in character, because they have resisted imperialism in some way, are put up on a pedestal. Now, I'm going to give the example not of the Mahdi, though we could use the Sudanese Mahdi as an example. I'm going to give the example of the so-called Mad Mullah of Somaliland, the Mullah of Somaliland, who organises an insurgency. And I talk about, there's a whole chapter devoted to this. It's a 20-year insurgency. And what I say about it is that, yes, it is directed against a relatively small British presence on the coast of Somaliland in this period, but it's primarily directed against ordinary Somalis. What the jihadists are actually doing is they're preying upon other Somalis who don't support the jihad. And Somaliland, as it is today, is immensely impoverished. It was immensely impoverished at the time, one of the poorest places on earth, desperately, desperately poor people. And you have this sort of jihadist insurgency imposed upon it. And it's really a kind of religious sanction for what is in effect larceny, what is in effect robbery, and so on. There's nothing remotely admirable about what is going on, about the movement that is led by the mullah. And yet he is regarded in Somalia today as a kind of anti-imperialist resistance hero. So, you know, he has statues in public places and that kind of thing. So one of the things the book is trying to do is to say that we need a much more realistic assessment of ways of resisting imperialism which are genuinely progressive and ways of resisting imperialism which are not. And that echoes absolutely in the present. Because if we think, I'm just going to throw a modern example in to give an indication of what I mean. If we think about the difference, contemporary events, we think about the difference between the fall of Saigon in 1975 to a genuine movement for national independence and economic development and social reform, which is what the Vietnamese National Liberation Front was. We contrast that with the fall of Kabul to the Taliban right now. The Taliban does not represent any kind of progressive future for the people of Afghanistan. It's a deeply reactionary movement. I think it's a form of fascism, actually, which targets women, which targets minorities, which targets people who are the wrong sort of Muslim. This is a form of fascism. It represents nothing in terms of improvement and reform for the ordinary people of Afghanistan. So we have to be very critical of a lot of these movements which emerge in response to imperialism, because they're not necessarily representing a progressive alternative.
Now, can anybody be said to have won these wars? I mean, what was the balance of power in this region in the years following 1920?
I think clearly the British, they do emerge in effective control of Northeast Africa. They keep the French out. They keep other European powers out. They eventually suppress all of the various Islamist insurgencies. And of course, coming out of the First World War, the British control even more of the Middle East than they did at the beginning. I mean, you know, British control expands across, includes Palestine, Jordan and Iraq as a result of the final settlement coming out of the First World War. So the British emerge as a more powerful imperial country as a result of all of these conflicts. However, in the somewhat longer term, what the British face is a different kind of threat to imperial rule, which is the emergence of an Arab nationalist movement, which I guess reaches its peak in the 1950s and the 1960s, where you get this wave of not just independence movements, but also movements which are driven by relatively radical Arab nationalist leaders who are saying it's not just about independence, it's also about developing our own economies, having control of our own resources, using our resources to bring about social improvement. So the 1950s, 1960s and the breakup of these old European empires is a period of relative significant progress in terms of improvements in the lives of ordinary people.
And finally, Neil, to what extent would you say that the Anglo-Arab War has poisoned relations between the people of this area and the West over the successive decades?
Oh, I think that's a very powerful thing indeed. I mean, I have worked as an archaeologist extensively in the Middle East, and I can tell you that the Arab street, if I can use that term, you know, ordinary Arab people are instinctively and universally suspicious of and hostile to Western imperialism, Western military intervention. It's a kind of knee-jerk political response to a history of invasion and exploitation and oppression. And of course, there are people who, when the War of Terror began, they said to Blair and Bush and the ones who were encouraging them, they said, look, if you put 250,000 Western troops into an Arab country, into the heart of the Middle East, you will reap the whirlwind. And they did reap the whirlwind. And the reason they did was because the people of the region have this history of the rape of their own countries, their resources, their civilization, and so on. And yes, it definitely goes back to the Anglo-Arab Wars of the late 19th century. That's possibly the most visceral historical experience. But it goes back further, of course, because the European incursions really began in the early 19th century. No question at all that this historical legacy, this collective historical memory, if you like, is still very much part of the politics of the world today.
That was Neil Faulkner. His book, Empire and Jihad, The Anglo-Arab Wars of 1870 to 1920, is published by Yale University Press. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow when Samita Mukherjee will be speaking about Indian suffragettes.